If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
Oh, what's happened? That shouldn't have... My apologies, everyone.
And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here with Shlomo. Of course, that isn't his real name, but I will be addressing him as Shlomo throughout this stream. And he is a German, content creator, YouTuber. Shlomo, welcome to Millennial. Again, this is another debut, so this is your first time, so welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on. Could you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. I've been a viewer of the show for the past few years, so I'm very glad to be here. And I've been making videos that were critical of mass migration since 2015. Back then, I was more like a classical liberal type, and over the years, I evolved into more of an, I don't know, identitarian, or at least influenced by those kind of people. In Germany, we have this Schnellruder people, these book people who I'm now involved with. And the last couple of years have sort of changed my perception of society from we need to enforce real liberalism to viewing humans as identitarian and tribal creatures, at least to some extent, and to try to get back on a more healthy understanding of ourselves and not demonizing aspects of ourselves that we need to survive.
Yeah, that's a very interesting summary. And we'll hopefully go through all of those different things that you've just mentioned. But it should also be said that you were imprisoned by in Germany about a year ago. So obviously we'll want to hear about that as well, because Germany, I actually think that in some senses, Germany has better freedom of speech than Britain. There's this stereotype that the Germans are it's an authoritarian sort of country, that's in the culture. But I don't think that's actually true. To a great extent, I think that Britain is worse. However, nonetheless, you were imprisoned. So we'll talk about that. But first, I want to hear about you said that you were more of a libertarian. If you could look back in time and try to remember, because I know 10 years is a long time in politics. If you could talk about how you viewed immigration then at that time.
The funny thing is, the things I was imprisoned for were almost exclusively from that time and out of that motivation. For example, I burned a Quran after Charlie Hebdo, after the attacks on the cartoonists, because I saw freedom of speech in danger from both Muslims and like the proto-woke, the left that at that time said that we shouldn't be racist and maybe the state should intervene when cartoons like these are drawn. And my reaction was maybe we should step it up a notch then. Maybe we should go a bit further than that if we are faced with deadly force and state authoritarian measures against us. And I think I wanted to defend the liberal core principles, which back then also included stuff like, it wasn't high in my list of priorities, but it included stuff like the Christopher Street Day, stuff like sexual freedom. The highest, I think, of my principles was freedom of speech. And I was politicized by these, as a teenager, by these American atheist YouTubers, like Amazing Atheist, who, as Americans, even though they were leftists, and it was kind of a different time, it was before they were seriously challenged, they were hardcore supporters of freedom of speech. I remember when, like, some Christian fundamentalist they went up against had his channel taken down, those people would platform him and would share his fundraisers or whatever, would go against this, even though they hated the guy. And as a teenager, that kind of impressed me and shaped my values.
At that time, what was the name of the channel that was taken down?
I don't know. I think like what was the he beefed himself. He had beef with a couple of Christian fundamentalist guys. I don't know the specific guy. So
it might have been Atheism is Unstoppable or something like that. I can't remember now. I mean, that is quite a long time ago. But that was the skeptic community. And and that was an interesting phase. But the other thing that you mentioned was Charlie Hebdo, and I think it's important to remember that they were a sort of old left organization, what we would call old left, which is sort of 60s, 70s, that they were up for freedom, and definitely freedom of speech, and were generally nihilistic, and they quite enjoyed just offending everyone. And that was Charlie Hebdo, and they had, I think people will know about this, and it was 2015, they had offended Muslims. I can't remember exactly how. They'd printed a cartoon of Muhammad in some way, and that led to a terrible massacre at their offices. And there was a sense of, in retrospect, that seems like an interesting moment, because it could have been a moment when the left and right came together in favor of freedom of speech, European values of freedom and integrity and honesty, freedom of inquiry, and so forth. But that didn't happen, because I think, as you say, the proto-woke, it was already there. And basically, they sort of threw the old left under the bus in that case, and then became very powerful and turned on the alt-right and so forth, and it became a big deal. So at that time, it was more about the danger of Islam, the threat from Islam. Obviously, you have to be careful about what you say, because you are in, well, both of us have to be careful what we say. But what would you say about Islam in Europe and Germany now, 10 years on from?
Is this my internet?
Yes, you can. I can hear you.
Oh, perfect, perfect. You were cut off at the end there, but I think I understood your question. I think we are faced with a population that is behaving more naturally than we are, and we are basically sick, which led to us letting them all in the first place. And now that they are in, they don't even need to be in a majority, for example, in a school or a prison or wherever people are being concentrated in large numbers, they become the most vocal and dominant group without any real resistance at like 20% or 30%, which stems from Europeans having been taught that when they when they go back to tribalism, when they just in a sense of I see that that the group of migrants that now runs the school essentially is bad for us, when they think ethnically, when they think in terms of their ethnic interests, they would go back to monstrous times of their ancestors where the Holocaust and World War II and stuff like that happened. And so there is this barrier of guilt before, I think, with Generation Z, it slowly is chipped at and slowly devolves. But in my generation, it was very strong. Plus, we for a long time had the luxury of not really having to think about this kind of stuff. And there also was this kind of aura of intellectualism around not caring about it. It was like the dumb lower classes would think in terms of ethnicity, race, culture, and the higher up classes, the people who were educated, would transcend this kind of thinking. And I think that is, in my generation, millennials, what most influenced self-harming behavior in terms of not realizing our own situation.
Absolutely. Before we get onto that, what would you say about Islam? You said you've talked in terms of ethnic identity. Would you say that there is also a religious identity? I mean, there obviously is. It is a religion. But would you say that the ethnic identity overrides the religious identity with Muslims or not?
I think it's a modern Western idea to even split those things up. I think most other peoples on Earth think of it as one, and in large numbers it behaves as one. You don't have a large number of like ex-Muslims even in Germany. Here it is the case that the Turks that are here are more nationalistic and more religious than those that are in Turkey, because I think they see us as an example of what could become of them if they get more secular. So I think individualism and liberal thought sometimes comes to right conclusions if you zoom in on specific individuals, but in large numbers, it's always false. And in large numbers, when you think about large numbers and policy that involves large numbers, like mass migration, it doesn't make sense to even split those two apart, ethnicity and religion.
Yeah, I agree. I think that these are just facts, and there's no point. I mean, you can't reason with people about this stuff. Their religion is so close to them, so valuable to them, that it's you can't get them to talk about it in an intellectual fashion. They're just not going to do that. So it ends up being, well, those are the Turks and they have a religion, and those are the Afghanis and they have a religion. But you can't separate them at all, I don't think. And I think this gets us to the problem of, well, of modern Europeans and modern Germans. We have sort of deconstructed our own identity to a ridiculous extent, and made ourselves very vulnerable in the process. You're a millennial like me. What would you say about growing up in Germany in the 80s and 90s?
I think back in those days, it wasn't as present. The funny thing is, even as I grew up as a millennial in the 2000s, there was this strong barrier of this is not being talked about and this is not something you should think about, made me not even think in those categories. So it took 2015, it took Charlie Hebdo, and it took the complete meltdown or complete radicalization of the left for me to even think in those terms. I can only imagine how it was for people who didn't even grow up in those conditions, who grew up in conditions who were way more stomachable than what I was faced with.
I think at that time there was also just a lot of comfort still, because the mass immigration hadn't reached the levels that we've seen since 2015, since 2015 and the migrant crisis. Would you say that at that time, in the 2000s, Germans were still quite naive about what mass immigration would do to Germany?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it was still possible to create this kind of matrix via mass media, via representations in popular culture, of it all coming together as basically fine. As there are some problems, but we are talking about them, and we have like talk shows where I don't know, it's like Ehrenmorde, honor killings are being talked about, and so we are heading, we are facing those problems, and we are gonna move past them at some point. And it wasn't like nowadays. Since 2015, I think there were like 3 years, 5 years or so that it took to sink in it, and it took to take effect on ordinary people enough for this matrix to completely collapse. And I think in Germany, this now has basically happened. The cat is basically out of the sack, and the political discourse is more or less not, is this good for us? At least when it comes to young people, it moved on to, do we deserve this? Do we deserve this because of our ancestors? Or do we deserve a life in dignity? That's more the question that is debated now. And back then, it was, I think, 2005 to 2010, most people were still on board with the idea that it was going to be fine over time. It was going to, they were going to assimilate, and maybe we are going to change a little bit ourselves, but it's going to shake out to something that is okay.
Yeah, wir schaffen das.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, that was 2015, when she said that. That was Merkel's slogan for, we can do this, we can manage this.
The interesting thing about that is the media that most importantly pushed this message and that pushed the Refugees Welcome campaign in Germany is the Bild-Zeitung, which is from the Axel Springer media house. Politico also is one of their medias, or one of their newspapers. And this is actually a conservative newspaper, or more conservative in the spectrum that was existent back then. I think since 2015, a lot of new newspapers and media outlets have come into existence. But back then, the boomer that just wanted to be left alone was most influenced by those conservative media outlets, and was for, as I said, about 5 years talked into agreeing with this and thinking of it as kind of like payback, or kind of like we are making up for the Holocaust. We are making up by welcoming all of these people for our bad history. So I have come to think, especially in the time that we have now, that these kind of media, these conservative, or at least masquerading as conservative kind of media, are the worst enemy and the most dangerous enemy that we have, because they actually reach people who don't already have come to their conclusions from the other side. The public broadcaster is pretty much only watched by leftists in Germany. The other newspapers like Zeit or Taz is only read by leftists. So it doesn't really matter what they say. The leftists are going to be on the side of letting them all in anyway. But newspapers like the Bild-Zeitung have had really a big impact.
Well, wasn't Merkel herself from, I think, the CDU, which is a sort of center-right party?
Yeah, yeah. She, in Germany, we call it Merkelization or something along those lines. She pretty much transformed that party, which wasn't perfect before she came either, but she made it into pretty much what the Greens and the left party wants 3 years ago. We are gonna actually do it now.
It's just incredible. The migrant crisis still now, 10 years on, it still amazes me what she did. And of course, it wasn't just her. And I'm sure that she was acting on orders from above. But she was the public face of it. And it was it looked like it was just an attempt to transform Germany forever, permanently, by changing the people, by literally changing the people.
Yeah, and right now we are already faced with a large number of people and a growing number of people who become German citizens from the 2015 migrant wave. And we are now debating, this is pretty much in the right-wing discourse in Germany, the hottest topic, whether we can find ways to get rid of them or to give them reasons to move back home, which we all know they, in large masses, still think themselves of as their home, without breaking the constitution, without getting target of repression and banning of our party. And I'm kind of, my school of thought is that it is way more important what most people think than what any judge thinks. I think most of the judges will soften their tone, at least, when the mood of the population has switched completely. And it is about to in Germany. I mean, after all of this, you can't imagine the level of propaganda that is being pushed out against our nationalist party, the AfD, on a daily basis. And still, we got to almost a third right now. Almost a third of the voters would vote for the AfD. We got a fifth by the last election. I think we are about, or in the next years, in the next probably 7 years, we are about to reach critical mass. And then the most important question becomes, is the system, is the CDU able to integrate us into the system and change us, or are we going to change them? And regarding this question, some people in the AfD want to come into power as soon as possible, which means in 3 years by the next election. And for that, they want to compromise on a lot of things. And then, at least that's my estimation, when you actually sit down at the table after you compromised on a lot of things to even get to that table in the first place, you are going to compromise on remigration. You are going to compromise on pushing the bulk of the people that came in since 2015 out of the country. And then the AfD is essentially just, well, just another tool of the system. And I'm of the opinion that we should wait at least one election cycle more till the CDU realizes that they have no future unless they come to us on our terms. And that's what's being debated in German right-wing circles right now.
Right. Well, obviously, I agree with you. As a foreigner, it seems much better to wait until circumstances are in your favor so that the establishment has to come to you and has to change, has to adapt to you, rather than the other way around. The last thing that anyone wants now at this stage is for the AfD to become cucked by the system. I suppose it's worth, before we get to your own story, we've talked about Germany over the last 20 years. We reached the migrant crisis and the fallout from that. Can you talk about the rise of the AfD over the last 5 years or so? Because to me, it's an amazing story.
Well, within the last 5 years, Probably the most interesting thing is that during Corona, they actually plummeted. They actually were very bad in the polls, did very bad in the polls, and there was sort of a panic even in the party that it wasn't going to be relevant anymore. We went under 10%, and by the election we just saw 2021 made 10%. It seemed to have worked to an extent to keep people in fear and keep people think about a different topic, even though that kind of blew up into their face in the end of it. But at the time, in the beginning phases of Corona, it kind of worked. I am kind of scared that the same thing could happen with the whole Russia ordeal, because that is the main instrument to divide the party right now. From the outside, we have a Verteidigungspolitiker, we have a defense political speaker of the party who right now has basically declared war on the most important symbol figure of more radical right-wing thought in the party, based on his stances to conscription in the military. Höcke, the guy who is probably the most famous, more radical AfD politician, says or doesn't want to support state conscription into the military because it isn't set in stone what is going to happen with the guys who are conscripted. It could be we don't want to give young people away as poker chips in geopolitical power plays by people we hate and by people that hate us, by people who kick in our doors and drag us to prison. And there is now this new kind of, it's not very big, but some important people in the party are part of this stream of thought. And the Verteidigungspolitischer Sprecher is one of them, the defense political speaker of the party. And they basically just declare with a lot of pathos, with a lot of emotion behind it, that you are a traitor to your nation if you don't support the strengthening of the military and the forced conscription of people into the military under the current regime, because you should just forget who the people are that are ruling above us right now. And think of Germany, think of the parts of Germany you love, and then defend that inside the army that is controlled by our enemies. And so this is kind of a good tool for splitting the party up and for attacking the more radical elements, which are mostly against this course, like Björn Höcke. Because you can use newspapers like, for example, the Bild-Zeitung to attack people like Höcke with the reach of millions of people. And those newspapers will happily print out whatever nasty thing you have to say about him and use you as a Feindzeuge, as we say in Germany, so as a witness from within the enemy ranks who can tell the people that he actually has to go. So this is a very hot inside AfD fight right now.
Right. So basically, the debate is whether to support a war against Russia or not. And using natural patriotic feelings to encourage young Germans to go to war. I mean, that's sick.
Exactly. Exactly. And even more than that, they want us to eat each other. They want us to attack each other on this basis. They want us to call each other's traitors on the basis if you want to fight for Merz or if you don't want to fight for Merz.
And are there many AfD supporters who do want to fight for Merz?
I don't think so. But there We have about 4 really big media, AfD-friendly media outlets in Germany, which are the Junge Freiheit, Tichys Einblick, News, which is run by a former Bild-Zeitungs-Redakteur, Bild-Zeitungs-Boss, basically, and then Julian Reichelt, and then we have Apollo News. Apollo News. These are the biggest AfD-friendly mediums, and all of them are on course with fighting for Merz. Are on course with. We shouldn't care who is in power. A strong military is what every patriot needs to want, and so we should give the state more power over young people, basically.
Right. Yes. And get them into uniform, get them trained up and sent off to Russia to get killed. It's dreadful. It's a terrible thing. I really hope that people don't fall for that trick. We're actually getting it the exact same thing here in Britain right now. Just over the last couple of days, there's been a military thing published that we're going to have to learn about sacrifice again. You know, parents are going to have to see their children die for patriotism again. And this is from a regime that despises patriotism and despises Britain. So I don't think many people will fall for it. I really hope they don't. But it's there, and it sounds like it's exactly the same thing that you're talking about in Germany, where a globalist regime will weaponize, will exploit patriotic feelings to get people to do what it wants, even though it's completely opposed to patriotism and nationhood. It will use those feelings that people have.
And which makes it even more ironic, that is basically part of the conflict in Eastern Europe. We get Ukraine on the same page culturally as the rest of the West? That is at least an aspect of it, and at least one thing that Russia feels threatened by, that we basically subvert more and more countries to Western way of life. And once we have done that, once we have installed in the young generation, or at least the important people on in universities in the young generation, these ideas of pretty much arbitrariness, cultural arbitrariness, and transcending ethnicity, transcending gender, transcending family. Once we have indoctrinated one generation with this, the country is basically destined to become part of the Western bloc. So it's also a power tool that can be used, but it is the sickness that we ourselves are dying from. So that makes it even more perverse.
Yes, indeed. And also at the same time, attacking the demographics of that country by flooding it with foreigners. We see this again in every Western country. So it's destroying that identity, even while you try to use that identity to fight your wars for you. It's really sick. All right, so with that said, we've explored Germany's political history over the last 25 years. What happened with you and your YouTube channel? I know that you don't have it anymore. So why don't you talk about how you started it, what your kind of content was on there, the videos you made, and then what happened?
Well, over the years, I had an insane amount of YouTube channels, like 150 or something, because at some point my strategy was just to spam. My viewers called me the Hydra, so this dragon creature that grows 2 heads if you cut off one. But in the beginning, funnily enough, my first bigger audience was reached by the public broadcaster in Germany censoring my videos. I got numerous DMCAs by this public broadcaster for just little snippets of videos like a Merkel interview, and I commented 30 seconds of it for a few minutes. They just went through my videos one by one and looked if anything of them was in there and manually strike those videos. And that was killed, what killed my first channel. And after that, the Streisand effect took full effect, and I went way bigger in a very short time. That was in the beginning of 2016, and no, it was in the beginning of 2017, end of 2016. And in the summer of 2017, I had an audience of about 250,000 viewers per video, and I did 2 videos a day. And in German numbers, that's even bigger than you would think of it in the English market.
In because, the English, yeah.
It's almost mainstream numbers. And after that, they began to just hate speech strike anything. Of course, my payment providers, my Patreon, but the channels were dropping like flies. And I just created new ones. I just tried to defy it by creating new ones, which worked for a time. But at some point, they were so focused on me, and they managed to push down my viewership to about 20,000 or something by this method, that it didn't really make sense. And then for like 2 years, in the years 2020 to 2022, I went on my own platform, Gegenstimme.tv. This was a platform I built myself, and of course there I couldn't reach any new viewers, so I just stagnated, and slowly a few people went away. I always had my podcast, which they didn't ban for a long time. They banned it after I went out from prison. One day after I publicly spoke about getting out from prison, they banned it. But I did have my podcast, which I did with another guy, KasperCast, since 2019, so for 6.5 years now. And that was allowed to stand for this whole time, and did pretty well. Probably a good episode did close to 100,000 views, and one that wasn't so popular did 20,000 views.
Those are very big numbers. I mean, even in an Anglosphere channel, that English-speaking channel, that those numbers would be huge. 100,000 viewers. That's amazing.
Yeah, 100,000 would be the exception. The medium would be probably at 45,000 or something.
Yeah. Well, for comparison, the most watched video on my channel was a Jordan Peterson speech, and it had 55,000 views. That was the most I ever got.
Interesting. Yeah. The good thing in Germany is that because the political sphere and the right-wing political sphere in particular isn't that big, you get access to pretty big politicians very soon. So we interviewed a couple of people, like the former ex-chancellor of Austria, and we interviewed Björn Höcke. We interviewed big politicians that everyone knew, because they were pretty much staffed for a platform, and there weren't so many people like us. So you have a pretty easy way to grow as a German right-winger.
Yeah, especially when it's a level playing field, when they're not starving you in every direction. It seems like it was a fun time for you. It was productive and successful. I had my own equivalent, and then they started on de-boosting and so on. So that's the story up until, well, when did the legal trouble start?
It started in 2020. In the summer of 2020, I first got a letter that something was going to court, probably, and that I should get a defendant for that. and it was about a couple of videos. The burning of the Quran, of course, was brought up, and in the end, they punished like 5 different instances. It was almost in all videos at the time that I did in the background, so they had a pretty easy time to just find something I said about Islam in those videos and then combine that with the Quran burning in the background. The other stuff was even more ridiculous. One thing, in the early years, I had some beef with basically German neo-Nazis. And those German neo-Nazis painted me as a Jew, which is actually where I got my name from, Shlomo. I took it from them. They called me Shlomo Finkelstein, and I then took that name to make fun of them. And I did the same thing with avatars they made of me, or they took my avatars and made like caricatures, Jewish caricatures from them, like the Happy Merchant meme. And then I just cut it out of their videos, and then I used those avatars as my actual avatars. I got sentenced for that. Those avatars were interpreted as anti-Semitic hate speech.
Oh dear. I can see what you were doing, but I can see how it backfired.
There was a couple of more stuff. One thing was just a picture of Goebbels, a historical picture, which was, funnily enough, I just have talked about Turks in Germany being more nationalistic than at home. In 2016, there was an election in Turkey if the power of the president, of Erdogan, was going to be expanded. And the Turks in Germany voted way more in favor of this than the Turks in Turkey. And
it's amazing. I just, sorry to interrupt. The same thing happened in the Netherlands and in Austria, where Turks voted to expand Erdogan's power. I remember this. It's very interesting. And of course, the same Turks will vote left within Germany, because that means that's good for them. But they'll vote right in Turkish elections. Really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we are basically just an example of what happens to you if you go down our path, and it makes people go the other way in way more with way more weight behind it. But yeah, I answered a video. It was brought up in a talk show, and the moderator said that as a good Democrat, he didn't like they voted this way, but as a good German, he doesn't want to criticize Turkish people. And I said to this, yeah, let's not have the old predator genes come up again. I think that's a sloppy translation, but I think what I mean is coming across. And in the same moment, to show what I meant, to show what he was talking about, why as a German he didn't want to talk about this, I showed this picture of Goebbels, which had a swastika on his arm. And that right. was showing extremist symbolism.
Right, yes. Even showing it is legally dangerous in Germany. Yeah, incredible.
You're basically fucked as soon as you show it in whatever context. I know of a case that just a few months ago was actually led to a sentence, which was the guy, funnily enough, who had his door kicked in because he called our then Wirtschaftsminister, then economic minister, Schwachkopf, which means idiot. The same guy was sentenced for posting a picture of a green politician showing a Hitler salute. Just a Photoshop picture, and to that he posted it with the text, are the Greens now completely insane? Are they the new Nazis? Just like boomer-esque stuff like that. It was completely obvious that it wasn't in favor of Nazism or something. But if you are a right-winger, the rule is basically they can compare us to Nazis as much as they want, as soon as anything that has to do with the subject shows up in a video or in a tweet that we do, we will get sentenced.
Yeah, it's a strange situation. So that was used against you as well. And then what happened?
Then I pretty much avoided the whole thing for a long time. So after the first letter, you need to know I didn't get any more letters because my then girlfriend, who was very young, she was younger than me at the time, it was back in 2019, she began to throw those letters who were sent back to me. I actually need to explain why I wasn't, I didn't live there where my Meldeadresse, where I was supposed to be in the eyes of the state. You have to register your address with the state in Germany. And I didn't do that where I lived in Dresden at the time, because back in Cologne, where I grew up and from where I moved to Dresden, I was visited by a bunch of Spiegel journalists, so mainstream journalists, who broke into my parents' garden and went from door to door in the neighborhood and told everyone that there was like a neo-Nazi living here. And I wanted to avoid the same thing in Dresden. So all of those letters...
Bloody hell, that's terrible. When did that happen in the story?
That was in the beginning of 2018.
Right. And so they somehow found your identity and went to your parents' house and terrorized, attempted. It was obviously harassment and intimidation.
Yeah, it was. In the end, they did some paywall article about me, but it was, they didn't really want to know from the neighbors if they knew that I lived there. They wanted to tell them that I lived there and what I did on the internet.
Yeah. Incredible, because then that isolates you and you have to explain this to your parents and they're worried and they're scared. It's just disgusting. So you were missing these letters, presumably, that were being delivered to the Dresden address.
Exactly. So in absence, I was sentenced in the end of 2020 to 1 year probation, which was the maximum sentence possible for those supposed crimes. And then my then girlfriend broke up with me, which was 1 year later, a good year later, at which point I actually found out about this and got the letters from back in the day, and also got pretty new letters which stated that I now needed to go to prison, because with this probation there was a payment of 600 euros attached to it that needed to happen until I think like less than a week, days before I got those letters and then made that payment. I then got a lawyer and she said that in all likelihood, it's gonna be fine. I'm gonna get probation again because German prisons are pretty full and they aren't hellbent on locking people up for nothing. But they were in my case, which she told me that it's very unlikely I go to prison pretty much till the very end of our fight against this. And then I just got a letter that said that I need to go to prison now. At the time that I got the letter, that was in the end of 2022, I had a new girlfriend and she was pregnant since, I think, 1.5 months. So if I went to prison now, I would definitely have missed the birth of my son. And I decided, I also talked to a cop friend of mine at the time who just told me about what's normal in this kind of circumstance, what kind of search measures are going to be taken against you. I decided that under the circumstances that I lived, with in my ways to create income without having to go to a traditional job, and me not living at my registered address anyway, I could just dodge it. And I tried that. That worked for 1.5 years. So I needed to go to prison. I need to go to prison since the beginning. There was a date in January 2023. And I didn't go and ignored it and used in VPN, just took a few precautions, but nothing special. And my cop friend told me it's just going to lie on some desk somewhere and nobody is going to look at it twice because they have much bigger fish to fry. And what happened then is that in the spring of 2024, shortly before they started to actually look for me, so more than a year after they had this arrest warrant against me, I was on a meeting. I went to a meeting with a bunch of AfD politicians. And one guy who, by the way, right now has flipped sides, who has gone to the other side. And I didn't tell anyone there about my arrest warrant, but I think I was seen with people who were important, especially at that time. And I think that someone who was, that is speculation, but I think someone there was Verfassungsschutz, so the Secret Service, the yes. Internal Secret Service agent, and pretty much just told his people that I was there, and I knew these people, and I talked to these people. I think that because one day after that meeting, I'm not joking, you can see this in the Akteneinsicht, in the you can see this in the paper trail. One day after, the BKA, which is the German version of the FBI, so the auf Bundesebene, on the federal level police, started looking for me, and they started looking for me intensely. They surveilled 5 people. They wanted to surveil about 20. They tried to surveil a lot more people. Some of them didn't go through with the judge, but a lot of them did. And then they killed my PayPal account. When I made a new one, I needed a new bank account because my bank account had been terminated years prior. And then they did a BaFin Abfrage. They asked the Central Banking Registry for my information exactly in the moment that I did, I made a new konto, and that's where they found out where I was, and then I was arrested in pretty spectacular fashion.
What a story. Can you describe the arrest? How did that take place?
Of course, I didn't know anything about all of this at this point, so for me it was a normal day. My son just turned 1 year old, and I did my usual walk with him and left the house. I wanted to go to the grocery store, and for the first year, I was the primary caretaker because my job just allowed it. I was way more flexible than my girlfriend with my time. As any day, I spent the whole day with my son, went out with him, and I got like 60 meters or so to the next bus station where a German guy, a well-built German guy, stood and asked me to explain the that's hard to translate. Taktung is the German word, which is an obscure word in Germany, a pretty pretty educational, or it isn't a word that normal people would use in normal conversation. Pretty much when the bus comes, but he says this like, I don't know, a professor from a university would maybe phrase it or something, which I find very weird because I now have to read this bus plan to a guy who uses language like this. So I go to the bus plan and take a look. And at this moment, I'm being jumped basically by about 15 men. And some of them are wearing ski masks and guns, and some of them are in civil clothes are not marked police officers, but undercover police officers. And they scream, and one of them, they scream police, police. But the most prominent thing that happens is that one of them, who is right by my ear, tells me, think of the child, don't do anything stupid, think of the child. Which, of course, kind of sounds like a threat in that moment when your stroller, I was walking him in a stroller, is being ripped away from the front, and from the back you are being taken and dragged into a street corner. It sounds like they are threatening to hurt your child.
Yeah. That's incredible. How did that... I mean, presumably you were just frozen with fear.
Yeah, in that moment, it all becomes so surreal that you don't really feel that much. It's more like watching a movie or something in that moment. It comes through later. The trauma, if you want to call it that, and some of the stuff that happened in prison, I'm sure... left some sort of trauma. That only sets in later. In that moment, it doesn't feel that gravely, but more like, is this really happening? I can't really believe this is happening.
Yes, yeah.
We were waiting then for about 10 minutes on the street corner. An old lady came by and asked them if they are the real police, which they said yes to. And then they had some sort of car, which brought me to the nearest police station. The interesting thing in the car is that those people, while I was blindfolded, by the way, they put a blindfold on me, a padded blindfold, like you would wear in a game show or something, if you weren't supposed to see what the other guys are doing. I had handcuffs behind my back, and I was sat there, and those people, 10 minutes after the arrest, were still breathing heavily for some reason. So I think they got told that this is like a high-risk arrest, that it was possible I was going to pull a gun or something.
Right, okay. This is often said that the police who carry out these operations don't actually know that much. They're only told exactly what they have to do, but they don't know the wider situation.
Yeah, I think that was the case here. And they, because I think of some corrupt judge or corrupt higher up that was supervising the whole thing, they got told misinformation, so they do it in the roughest way possible. I mean, I've never been sentenced for any violent crime or something, so my fucking crime, the most prominent, the crime that I got the longest sentence for with 6 months was Raka Raka Ali, What the Black Says. I'm not joking.
Right. So at this point, it was, were they putting you in prison because you hadn't paid the 600 euro fine, or were they putting you in prison for the actual online content?
Because I hadn't, it wasn't a fine, it was like, I don't know if what's the correct word, it was one of the conditions of parole. So because I failed to do that in time, parole was revoked, and with that I had a 1 year sentence.
Right, okay, I understand now, yeah. Okay. So, what happened next?
Then I spent the night in that police cell. It was like a Ausnüchterungszelle, a cell for drug addicts or drunks without a toilet. And then I was brought to the first prison. The first of 11, by the way. I was shipped around the entire country for the next 2 months. I've seen, I think, like 30% of the prisons that we have in Germany during that time. Because I wasn't registered, my address wasn't registered in East Germany, where I live right now. They brought me back after a week in the first prison in Cottbus in East Germany. They brought me back to West Germany, to the border, to the Netherlands. So across the entire country. And on the way, of course, I met a lot of drug addicts and fucked up people beyond belief.
Just before we get to that, when you were being taken to these different prisons all around Germany, did you know where you were going? Did you know where you were?
Yeah, I didn't know the stops in between. I knew that eventually I was supposed to go to the prison in Siegburg in Nordrhein-Westfalen, which turned out to be wrong. I didn't stay in Siegburg. I was shipped there for like 5 days, and then I was transported to Remscheid, which is near Siegburg. And in Remscheid, then I stayed 16 days while they decided what to do with me.
And why? Yeah, okay, so they were deciding what to do with you. That's why they were moving you around, I guess. Why did they eventually take you to the Netherlands? That seems a very strange thing to.
Not the Netherlands, just the border to the Netherlands. I was transported with a bunch of prisoners who were actually from the Netherlands and who were being deported or something. But it is because my last known registered address was in Cologne.
Right. Okay. Yes, that makes sense. And you were saying about these very fucked up people that you saw there. Well, what was that like? Because I'm guessing that this is stuff that you'd never, this is a life that you hadn't lived before.
Yeah. So the first thing that was very unpleasant is that I, of course, draw a lot of attention because I fall out of what is expected to see in a prison. And so people were suspicious. If your story doesn't make sense, and I couldn't really tell them the whole story, at least not on the travel on those between stations, I hypothetically probably could have done that because they didn't have the time to like Google me, because people Google each other in prison either because they have handies, they have phones that are smuggled in, but more likely than that, just by calling the outside world through the official ways, and they do that a lot. So if you are too interesting to them, they will Google you, and in my case, they would have found the burning of the Quran on Google page number one when they Googled my name, and then I would have had a real problem. So I needed to avoid drawing too much attention. And for that, I stole the story of one guy, a Turkish guy I met in Cottbus, who was in prison for driving without a license. And his story was that he drove without a license like 20 times, but they caught him only once. And they saw surveillance videos from a gas station and then deducted that because he was there so often, he must have had driven so many times. And I stole that story, which worked pretty well. The problem is, if people get suspicious of your story, the first thing they will think, especially if you don't really fit the picture of a normal prisoner, that you are a child molester. Because those are the people that try to, or at least a rapist, at least a sexual predator. Those are the people that really try to cover up what they did in prison and just make up stories. So you are in a constant state of adrenaline, and you are dealing with people like, for example, in Bielefeld, I met this guy that bit off a finger of a policewoman. And Generally speaking, everybody is on spice. A lot of people are on spice, which is, I think, in British prisons, the drug of choice too.
And I don't know what is spice. I don't know what that is.
Spice is perfect for prisons because it is just made of paper, like normal sheets of paper that are submerged in a liquid that contains like some strong, something like synthetical marijuana, cannabis, something along those lines, but a lot stronger and with very heavy tolls of you if you go through Entzug, if you can't get it. Also, you can die. Withdrawal, right, sorry. Also, you can die if you take too much of it. It sends your heart into overdrive, and most people have a panic attack the first time they smoke it because their heart just goes so fast. But in prison, it's omnipresent. And this guy was a dealer in this stuff. He dealt in prison, like many people do. Many, many people in West Germany especially do in prison. It works like this. A lawyer, mostly like a clan, so Arabic clan lawyer, someone of a criminal family, sends in a letter with a big writing or something, or they can't even look into this letter, so it doesn't matter. It can just be plain paper, and this paper is being has spice in it, and it then gets cut up into very small pieces, and all of those pieces go by like $10 or something, and they really make a lot of money doing this. This guy bit the policewoman's hand off, wanted to pretty much pressure me into taking this stuff, first in a friendly manner, then when I rejected, he wanted to pressure me into playing spice Russian roulette. He put so much of this stuff into his cigarette that he, as a long-time consumer, only could take like little small drags, and he was completely gone after them. And he had made a cigarette like that, and he had made a normal cigarette, and he wanted to pressure me into choosing one. And he also told me this one is the one without it. Now smoke it, just to have fun, basically, just to play a mind game on me. And he also bragged that he could kill anyone anytime he wanted in prison just by spicing them, just by putting so much spice in their cigarette that their heart collapses, because no one would look at it a second time. It would just be another junkie death. Generally, people talk about this all the time on transport, when you are being shipped to another prison and being locked up with like three new guys or something, because on transport you're always locked up with a bunch of people. People always talk about how many collapsed on their Freistunde, on their going outside.
Wing, that's the present.
Yeah. It mostly happens when people are being brought out to take a walk for an hour. And
all right, the exercise yard.
Yeah, exactly. How many people collapsed on their exercise yard last time? So it's the defining topic of prisons in Germany.
God almighty. So was there a sort of atmosphere of tension and fear in prison? Because people say different things about prison. It sounds like there were some people, some individuals who were very much dangerous individuals.
Yeah. I ended up working with some of them. In the end, I was brought back to East Germany because it wouldn't have been possible for my family, my son, my girlfriend to visit me in West Germany. And then I ended up in Brandenburg an der Havel, so in near Berlin. And there I was pressured into taking a job, which wasn't a real job, like, I don't know, cleaning or something. But it was actually a simulated construction site within the prison where we built walls, and later we doesn't matter, we did a bunch of we threw that stuff on the wall that in the end makes up the surface of the wall and made it even. There I was locked up with pretty bad people. One of the guys had 12 years. He was the biggest problem. There was also a murderer, but I actually got along with the murderer because he was a pretty normal guy. He just snapped, and he was a little bit psycho, but he wasn't like a career criminal like this 12-year guy. He got 12 years for two things. One of them was hitting a guy with a full energy drink bottle on the head until his head was virtually non-existent. He survived, but he was heavily maimed by this. And during the same time, he threw someone out of the second story window, which was then dropped because the new charges against him were so grave that they thought that didn't matter now. So this guy pretty much was a violent criminal chauvinist. If your crime wasn't violent, he didn't think much of you. And of course, me telling them that I was there because I drove without a license, that's pretty much the lowest thing for someone like that you can think of. And that guy he sometimes threw stuff at you. It was mostly with a smile afterwards, or like a schoolyard bully who has a laugh about it afterwards so he doesn't get in trouble, basically. One time he came into the smoking room there on this construction site where I was sitting alone. He brought one other guy with him and threw a Zollstock. What's this thing called? Not a ruler, but like the construction site version of a ruler, a very big ruler you can...
Yes, I know it. It's I think we call it a spirit level. I'm not sure. A meter stick.
A meter stick. Yeah, exactly. He threw that into my balls, which really hurt. And this guy was way stronger than me. I'm a meter and 75 centimeters tall. This guy was taller than me. This guy, all he talked about was violence, and I think pretty much all of his life up to this point consisted of violence. So I was much weaker than him, but...
Was he a white guy? Was he a German?
He was a white guy, actually, yeah. Yeah.
Right,
the guy he brought with him was an Iranian. We had an Iranian there, which also had a funny dynamic. This Iranian often did like Nazi stuff, like building a swastika out of stones or something. People were always jealous because, you know, in prison, people are generally more of a dark humored nature. And this... the German prisoners didn't like that the foreigners could just do stuff like this and get away with it, while they would get in serious trouble for it. But I got along with him. He was sort of a Bart Simpsons-like character. He always talked about how in another prison they used something they built themselves out of forks and rubber to kill the electricity by ramming it into the power station or the power holes in the wall and stuff like that. So in an anarchic way, he kind of was funny. But this stronger guy with 12 years threw the meter stick in my balls. It really hurt. And I got angry and threw it back at him. I stood up, threw it back at him with some power and hit him somewhere on his chest. And he told me the mood immediately changed. He had this laugh, which he always had after he did something bully-like to you. And after I threw it back, he came... very, very close, like a centimeter from my face or something, and said, if this hits my face we will have a real problem. You're not going to stand up after it. And went on like that for a couple of minutes, which put me in the spot that if I now completely give in, I look so weak that there was this other guy seeing it, that if this becomes the talk, everybody is going to do stuff like that to me. It's going to give off the vibe that you can just do to me whatever you want and I won't fight back. So I had to somewhat show strength, which I did in just not backing down. So we had this kind of back and forth where he threatened to kill me, essentially, or at least hitting me, and I wouldn't get back up again. I'm just going back to the point that I don't want anything to be thrown between my legs. And that goes back and forth until he shouts, shut the fuck up. It ends with, was willst du, was willst du, what do you want from me, what do you want? I don't want stuff being thrown between my legs. I don't want any trouble, but all right, then now shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up. And after that, we sit there in silence. I take the last few drags of my cigarette and leave the room. And the funny thing is, after this happened, that guy became way more respectful of me. That was the last time he ever, I don't know, threw anything at me or in a spiteful way made fun of me. So it actually paid off. Not completely backing down does pay off in prison.
That's interesting. Because a lot of people would think in a situation like that, that you should probably just give in because the guy is a psycho. And fighting back will only make it much worse. But actually, it's a matter of power relations, and he's looking for your limit, and he found it, and then he left you alone.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. This guy also kept bitches as he, one bitch, one guy who did everything for him. He cleaned his toilet and stuff like that. And so this is where you end up if you don't fight back at some point.
When you say bitch, does that mean the obvious thing that he was?
No, I don't think it was sexual, at least not overtly, or at least not physically. I think he enjoyed the power, and maybe that had this component psychologically, I don't know. But the stuff he talked about was always just that he does everything for him, and he really liked that. And I think more than the practical side of it, he just liked the dynamic of it. He liked that he has that power over him.
Right, right, right. He sounds like an awful person, but also kind of straightforward.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. If you will either be his bitch or you will stand up to him, and then he'll basically leave you alone. He
yeah.
seems a guy who's very interested in power and really not much else. I mean, you said that all he ever talked about was violence.
Yeah, and in a very over-the-top way, he talked about feeding people to the pigs. He was working like an enforcer or something, like someone who is involved with the dirty work in a drug cartel. And I think he went way over the top with the stuff he talked about. I don't think this happened the way he describes it, but he says that there were like Russian or Eastern European farmers that they knew, and they often killed someone and then brought them to this farmer, and then those people were fed to the pigs. And he talked about this often. He really enjoyed topics like this.
That's it just reminds me of the film Hannibal from, I think, 2002. Maybe he'd watched that.
I think he didn't really have a lot left in his life apart from this. I mean, he still had, I think, 7 or 8 years to go. He was going... That's also a funny aspect, what they did with people like him. Basically, they have conditioned people like him to talk in a specific way when they are faced with the social workers who are, at least in the Fachwerkstatt, in this construction site simulator, there was always a social worker who was pretty much the boss of this kind of thing in the prison, who was walking around there. And when she came, he always talked like a school child that knows that he has done something wrong, but that is on the way of redeeming himself. And they all talked like that. They all learned this specific tone that these social workers wanted to be talked to in, so they gave them stuff. That's pretty much the only thing that the prison system accomplished with them. They taught them how to manipulate these women, these mostly in 9 out of 10 cases women, who then could talk themselves into thinking that their job is valuable and that they are creating a better society by doing it. And what they are doing is, for example, this guy, this 12 years guy, was with the murderer together in the in the part of the prison that was for very extreme violent inmates and sexual predators. And what they did there was, for example, building masks out of clay and painting them with colors to, I don't know, channel the inner child or something. Or painting Easter eggs or something, also group therapy and weird. I think the prison, in a way, is just using all of the money to give those 30-year-old women the feeling that this works and that people actually are the way they would like them to be, and they can heal like an ex-murderer with letting him paint a clay mask.
Amazing. So it's a system that's geared for the delusions of childless 30-year-old women.
Basically, yeah. And they all make fun of it. When they are out of the room, they all really, they are actually literally laughing about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, they need to
write journals, and they are meeting psychologists every 3 days or something. And this guy actually often had violent outbursts, and I mean real violent outbursts, more than just with the meter stick in this prison. One time he threw chairs and grabbed a guy because he felt disrespected in some group therapy session, and threw him into his cell. And there never were any real consequences up to the point where someone accused him of being racist. And I'm not joking. It sounds like I make this stuff up because it fits so well into my, I don't know, the stuff I talk about all the time. But it really was that way. At some point, he got into a scuffle with, I think, an Afghan or a Syrian or something like that. And I think it was an Iraqi, actually. And after this not so grave incident, I think they like wrestled a bit or something. They pushed each other and shouted something, but that was pretty much it. They weren't like heavily wounded or something. After that, the Iraqi went to the authorities and said that he attacked him because of his ethnicity. And after this incident, something really happened. After this incident, he came back to the construction site simulation and was really, they talked to him in a way, he was about to lose his place in this intense care and intense psychological facility inside the prison that also gives you the chance of getting out years earlier. And they really told him, you are about to lose this place. We are having a conference about you, and you could really be kicked out. And this never happened before. This never happened, no matter what he did, no matter who he hurt, no matter, for example, he couldn't go to church in prison because he threw tables and chairs there. So he had been violent everywhere he went. But this one time was the only time they took it seriously. It is insane.
Yeah, that's incredible. Do you think that any of those men are helped by being in prison, or is it simply that prison keeps them away from the public? Is that the only good that it does?
I think for 97% or something like that, it's the latter. It's only that they are being kept away, and the only thing that the prison does for them is the effect of deterrence, which they don't even really want to have because they don't believe in it. It's actually the only thing that works. But the people still don't want to be there, even though it's not, I don't know, bread and water kind of confinement. But it's the only thing that works. So I think for people like him, that's basically what you need. You don't need to go back to the Dark Ages, but you could just take the television away, for example. You could just lock them up a little bit more. You could just take yummy food away and replace it with nutrient-rich but not so yummy food, for example. So after a few years of this, they just say, we don't ever want to live through this again. Funny enough, the murderer I've mentioned was one of the few people who was actually reached by this, but not in a good way. I think you could do it in a good way, but he was indoctrinated in a weird thing in this psychologically heavily in this area of the prison where they are being worked on psychologically heavily. There are many, many, most people, I think 80% of them, are sexual predators, and most other people hate them, of course. So the prison built their own narratives while they aren't so bad, so they can live together with those people and there's no violence. And those narratives are pretty weird. It's kind of like a continuum fallacy based on sex and rape. This guy, this murderer who pretty much ate up anything they said, he was pretty much just a voice of those social workers. He told me, for example, that we are all kind of rapists. Each and every one of us would have had any case of sex with our girlfriends or with someone we met at a party or whatever that was unclear, that was somewhere in the gray zone where there was no clear yes, and that the difference between a rapist and a non-rapist often would be just if you got caught or if you got if the woman went to the woman went to the police. And this is what they tell them there. I think not only because they don't want violence to happen, but also because they kind of believe it. Because it does seem like the sexual predators are being somewhat viewed more favorably by the prison system than the violent criminals or the ordinary violent criminals. At least that's what every violent criminal I was able to talk to told me. They are seen as sick, while the violent criminals are seen as pretty much more than sick, but they can't help themselves. They have an addiction. It's more like a drug addict or something than someone who is evil.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is probably true. There is a lot of grey area. And this is why I remember about 10 years ago, there was that song, what was it called? The Grey Lines or
Blurred Lines?
Straight Lines. Or Robin Thicke, his song. And feminists really were annoyed by this, that it implied that sex is a grey area, I guess. I mean, it's not like there's a contract signed by both parties at the start of it, you know, nothing like that. But that is the truth. That is how it is. And after the fact, women can claim that something terrible happened to them, and the guy can't really prove that didn't happen. So it's a very difficult area. So yeah, okay. So there was one other thing from your time in prison that you wanted to talk about, and I think people will want to hear about, which is the petting zoo.
Yeah.
Oh, but before we get to that, you should maybe describe the demographics of the prison.
Oh yeah, in East Germany, almost at the border to Poland in Cottbus, and pretty close to the border to Poland in Brandenburg an der Havel, it is 60% Eastern European, 30%, 25% German, and the remaining 10-15% Arab migrants. In
right.
West Germany, it is drastically different. In West Germany, it is, I would say, 70% Arabic migrants. Some black right. guys, the rare Eastern European, and then maybe 20% Germans.
Right. Okay, and this main prison that you've just talked about, was that in West or East Germany?
Where I stayed the longest, it was in East Germany.
Right, okay.
But close
all
to
right. Berlin. Yeah, I'm familiar with Brandenburg, vaguely. Okay, so then get to the story about the pettings.
The petting zoo. So I was told firstly by inmates and then also by a guard who began telling us that story without being provoked in that way or without anyone really asking for it. There was a petting zoo, a small petting zoo consisting out of two female goats in the permanent confinement or preventive custody department, which is for criminals that won't be let out ever, or at least not for a long time, although they have served their sentence, because they are deemed too dangerous for the public. And all of them, or most of them, almost all of them, in Brandenburg an der Havel, in this facility, are sexual predators. Also real, real hardcore sexual predators, you can imagine. Not like date rape or anything, but real, mostly with children or something, or just a stranger woman dragged into bushes and maybe killed afterwards, stuff like that. One guy, funnily enough, I think he's in a different prison now, but one guy who was in this facility killed women with an axe, then killed their babies, killed relatively newborn babies by punching them or throwing them on a wood, on a tree stump, and then taking the clothes of the woman, who later argued that he did this kind of like in The Silence of the Lambs, because he himself was a woman and needed to get in touch with his identity. He was then offered to castrate himself by transitioning, and then he could get out, but he refused to do that. But yeah, those are the kind of people who are there. And they got this petting zoo, and they were actually in charge of taking care of those animals. And then one day, the vet came and looked at the animals and saw that in both of them, the nipples had grown to an unnatural and unhealthy size, which with goats actually happens without being fertilized, without being pregnant, but just by having sex. If a goat has a lot of sex, it begins to produce milk, or at least starts the process in their breast tissue that will eventually lead to producing milk. And if it's happening a whole bunch, if it's happening every day, but no pregnancy happens, it actually leads to a sickness. It leads to something that is painful for the animal, and that was seen by the vet. And after that, they took evidence from their genitals. They found human sperm, and they raped the goats, and they raped the goats repeatedly. They must have raped the goats an almost unthinkable number of times.
And is it known which prisoners would have done this? Would this have been Germans, or would it have been the 5% or 10% Arabs, or what?
I have no information about this. The prison itself is relatively harsh about it. I think it was most of them, or at least multiple of them, who were there. I think there were like 15, 14 people there, and probably a mixture, I'm not sure. Interesting is that in the same prison, in the JVA Brandenburg an der Havel, since then, very recently, there was a case of a child being taken to a visit in the Maßregelvollzug, which is a special part of the prison, which is also for mentally disturbed people and prisoners. And the child that was taken there by the girlfriend of the inmate was then raped by the inmate in the visitor's room. So,
that's incredible. That's terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. This kind of thing can happen. I imagine. I, for example, was surveilled because they were. When I had my visits, and also my phone calls were surveilled after I did this JD Vance video, after I did this video where I talked in English about all the things that had happened to me. I always had to ask to even phone people, and someone had to directly listen to it so he could kill the call in the case that I would reach out to the public again. My visits were also surveilled. I was strip searched, I think, 5 or 6 times after that. Strip searched in the sense you get completely naked. We have to lift up your balls so they can look if you hide drugs or anything under there. I think they were afraid of a phone. If it wasn't just chicanery. This guy, you see the priorities they set, just with my arrest, just with this FBI, German FBI manhunt after me, they could have used those resources to find like big-time drug dealers or rapists or something. They chose to use it on me. They could have used the surveillance capabilities that they had on this disturbed, probably from before, sexual predator, I would guess, when he was meeting with this child, but they didn't. They let him rape that child because it's more important to the German justice system to protect their own publicity, protect their own standing, than to actually prevent harm.
How did all of this affect you while you were in prison?
That's a difficult question.
I know that happened after you left prison. I'm just asking about your experience of prison.
Yeah, psychologically?
Yes.
At some point, I got into a mindset that what happened to me isn't that important. I, of course, wanted to avoid dying. But apart from that, I kind of thought, all right, these months that I've got left will be hell, but who cares? They will go by. And after that, I need to, for basically, I need to use this time and use my confinement here as a weapon against the German justice system and against the people who control it, because I will never be able to get this much publicity. And this was actually what maybe led to my me being let out almost 3 months early after this actually was rejected in the first try. Because I had numerous things planned. I started with this video. After that, I was gonna have a protest in front of the court that rejected my parole hearing.
Yeah.
Again, my appeal. Parole hearing. And then, out of the blue, the next higher court decided to let my appeal go through and let me out, while they also cooked up, and maybe I should mention that, I was visited by the Verfassungsschutz, by the German Interior Secret Service in prison. They wanted to talk to me. I rejected to talk to them. And then a few days later, firstly, I got a letter dated a few days later that there are new cases against me, cases for tweets, for using the name Ahmed and Mutumbu as stand-ins for African migrants and Arabic migrants, new Volksverhetzungscase, new hate speech case, and that pretty much killed, that was directly before my hearing, so that killed any chance of getting out early, because if there is an open case against you, it looks like you just keep going, and why would they let you out earlier? Also, I was being attacked in the prison by some guy who presented himself as a neo-Nazi. He was kind of a weird neo-Nazi. He had things, these tunnels in his ears. He looked more like a leftist, although he was a tall and well-built leftist in this case. But he also, he all the time, he used these neo-Nazi language. He did the salute. It was also interesting that he got away with it, because he did it pretty openly. He didn't do it right before the guards, but he did it on the floor, on the on our station, not in his cell alone. So you would think that at some point he would be caught and then he would be in trouble. He was placed on my floor about a week after the Secret Service visited me, and he started attacking me after we hadn't said anything to each other apart from good morning. He said something else than good morning. He started to attack me when we were on our way to the exercise hof?
Yard.
Exactly. He started to attack me. He put me in a chokehold and pulled me down the stairs. After that, he told me that he became gay in Maßregelvollzug, in the special needs or special psychological prison part. It always happened in the same part of the stairs where I think cameras couldn't look into, which was like a dead spot of video surveillance. And he pulled me back another time, this time not taking me in a chokehold, but pulling me on my clothes, on my butt, around my neck. And this was really weird, because it's not usual that you get attacked without any build up to it. For example, with that guy that threw the meter stick at me, there was build up to it. He built up to it by doing little things, remarks, and beginning throwing anything at me. This guy just started doing it only to me, and for no apparent reason. We hadn't talked, we hadn't, established any kind of negative or positive relationship, so it didn't make any sense. And my speculation is that this guy was sent, it doesn't have to be the case, but this guy could have been sent by the Secret Service, because they recruit people exactly like him, neo-Nazis or people who are from the antisocial variety, who go out drinking and beating each other silly, who have trouble with the law, recruiting them and making them assets and putting them in prisons. My lawyer, for example, warned me that if I talk to the Verfassungsschutz, to the Secret Service, and I reject, they would start doing stuff like, for example, shit in my shoes. Actually, that was his example. When I would take a shower, some of them would just take my shoes and take a shit in them. Stuff like that could happen. He had actually witnessed stuff like that. And right. So it kind of fits the picture.
Right, okay. And so what you said that they launched more charges against you when you were about to go up for parole, and that ruined your chances of parole. In the end, how much time in prison? How long were you in prison?
9 months and I think a week or 1.5 weeks.
Right. And were those other charges pursued? Did they convict you on those charges?
Most of them are now dropped. Most of them are now completely gone away. They came up with one new thing. I probably shouldn't speak what exactly it concerns, but it would be one thing. Maybe I can talk about this. One thing is actually funny. We will see if this goes to court, but this isn't the big thing. The other thing is also you would find it completely ridiculous, but with the German court system, it could come through. One thing that they are now leveling against me is that I used a character from a kids show of the public broadcaster in a meme. They are saying that I committed copyright infringement with that. It's the Sendung mit der Maus, which means the show with the mouse. And I took said mouse and used it in a meme with a Germany flag, which was a reaction to them using their own children's character with a pride flag. So that's one of the things that is still running against me, but the Mutumbu charge got dropped.
Right, okay. Are you concerned about the mouse charge, that you could go back to prison?
I think that public opinion has something to say about this. The parole judge I got, a woman who was pretty much or probably in her early 30s or something, I think if I get someone like her, yeah, I'm fucked. It doesn't matter what it's about. She's gonna sentence me to the maximum she can, no matter what the circumstances or what the crime is. But I think in most of East Germany, I have better protection with this, because the judges here, I think in most aren't insane leftists. They are more like normies. And if you are already known as someone who by now openly advocates using this kind of stuff to demolish the legitimacy of those offices of the German justice system, I think they are going to be a little more careful. So I would be surprised if I go to prison again.
Right. Well, I certainly hope that you don't. It sounds like it didn't do you much damage. It sounds like you were quite psychologically resilient against the experience. But nonetheless, I wouldn't want you to go back.
Funnily enough, the time right afterwards where I ran around Germany basically and drove there and there and gave interviews and talked about this stuff again and again and again. Now it's lays many months in the past, and there has scar tissue built above all of this stuff, but that really didn't feel good. That was really, really, really unpleasant to warm it up again and again and again and again right after living through it and also lecturing my book and stuff. Just basically obsessing about this stuff while your subconscious just wants to hide it from you and let you move on. That really didn't feel good. But I think by now, By now I mostly moved past it.
Right. And you said that you wrote two books in prison.
Yeah, I wrote one book, which is just about the prison experience, which is called Bauzeit, which came out at Antaios. And it's already out. It's it's just pretty much the story of all that we just talked about, but in way more detail and describing. I think it's also a funny book. I think it's most people who read it have told me that it's an entertaining read. I think it's not out in English yet, but maybe that would be a possibility for the future. And the other one is yet to come out. The other one is about political theory. And that stems from me sitting in prison and having nothing to inform myself and to distract myself but the television, and then watching television, watching political talk shows, watching news and stuff, and always being confronted with the liberal democracies who are in danger by autocracies and by their enemies from within and stuff like that. And my main goal was to find another word for what they mean with freedom when they call themselves liberal in nowadays world. And I did that by replacing freedom with, I think the English word would be arbitrariness, Beliebigkeit. Im Deutschen. The book is called An Empire of Arbitrariness. And my theory, simplified, is that the core value of modern Western civilization is to replace any identity that is rooted in something fixed, in something that cannot be changed, like ethnicity, ancestry, gender, sex, or family. Those identities have to be replaced with something that is changeable, that is defined by its arbitrariness, by the one who defines himself through this, being able to change it at the wave of a pen or at a new mood he gets into. For example, basically anything that humans really, really define themselves by naturally is being ridiculed and mocked. If you define yourself over this, at least as an indigenous European, you are just a loser and a ridiculous clown. And anything that is arbitrary, anything that actually isn't you or that you just picked, like a new gender, that's the best case. You made it up. If you made something up, you can make anything up. And gender is pretty much the way to get rid of the concept of biological sex by socializing it and making it pretty much the same as the mood you're in or something. That is the most protecting, worth the most protection on the planet. That is something that really defines you. And if anyone in Germany, for example, we have a law that if you use the wrong pronouns for someone who has had a legal sex change, you will have to pay up to 10,000 euros. So that is protected by law. It is protected by a big stigma. And all of this is basically just spam. It is not really important to them. The kind of new cake gender or something, that is just something they throw in to drown out the actually important stuff, like family, like your actual sex, like your actual ancestry, like your actual ethnicity, and to let it disappear in just a wave of the spam, which then is ultra protected and the focus point of the society. That's how I replaced the word freedom in modern liberalism.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very valid analysis. I think they're desperate for people to be as rootless as possible. And so any identities that people would naturally have and take pride in and be reassured by have to be invalidated and made verboten so that they're sort of desperate, so that they're looking for something, anything that they can hold on to. I think that's a big part of what we've seen over the last 50 years. It's a very unnatural situation. Well, I've just realized the time. I was enjoying listening to your story so much that I sort of lost track of the time. And I'm afraid that my next guest is already due on. So we're going to have to end this one now. But there were a couple of super chats, just people saying thank you from Don, and Ethernet saying some dollars. Thank you very much for that. What you said that you your podcast was shut down the day after you got out of prison, or the day after you talked about your prison experience?
Yeah, exactly. I was out for like 3 days, but I made a short video on Twitter in which I said that I would talk about the Verfassungsschutz, the Secret Service, and everything that happened. And a day after this video, also my channel was taken down, my personal channel, but Honigwabe, the podcast, was also taken down. And since then, we could only stream on Twitch and Twitter.
Right. And so I'm guessing that has reduced your reach, your viewer base quite a lot.
Drastically, yeah.
Yeah. Do you stream onto X, onto Twitter?
Yeah. It's one of our two main platforms. We have the KasparCast is his name. That's it's my co-host. Twitch channel. We stream there, and we stream on my Twitter account, Shomo96.
Right, yes. Well, people, that will be linked below so people can find it. I wish you luck, and I hope that they don't put you back in prison, and I hope that you're able to reestablish what you had built in the first place. I don't know what is coming with the censorship on social media. It looks like it could get bad again. But I also think that the situation in our respective nations will have an influence on that. And as we were saying before, the AFD look like it's almost inevitable that they're going to be in power in Germany. Now, I was going to say that they're going to take over Germany, but that's maybe not the right way, right phrasing. But it seems like that's just destined to happen at this point, in which case freedom of speech, I think, will enjoy a revival there.
It's, I think, most important that we guard what kind of AfD it will be that takes power. I think their most prominent or most promising angle of attack right now is changing the AfD to something that could be turned against us. And maybe that as a last short note, my horror scenario for the AfD is that they will become the CDU's lapdog and enable them to implement something I call law and order cucking. That means we don't change the demographics, but we become as authoritarian as we have to be to calm things down. And calm things down in terms of Muslim migrants, in terms of Islamists, but also then in terms of the right wing. Basically, this all would happen under a liberal framework, under an extremism definition that stems from the arbitrariness as the highest value of the society that I've just mentioned. And that basically then encaptures us with the Islamists together. And the people on the right wing who aren't thinking that deeply could be happy that the situation, at least for the rest of their lifespan, is being calmed down a little by being more authoritarian to this those migrants. I oppose this. I think we need to fix demographics. And I think before we are in a position to fix demographics and begin to do this, we shouldn't become more authoritarian and shouldn't give the current state more power, ultimately also over us.
Oh, I completely agree. That would be, as you say, that would be the worst case scenario. Let's just hope it doesn't go in that direction. I really hope that the AFD holds the course that they're on, that they've been on. And I think their victory is inevitable if they do that. It might not happen in 3 years, but it will certainly happen in 7 years, I would think. So, yeah, I agree with you. All right. On that note, though, we'll have to end this one. I wish it could go on longer because this has been a fascinating conversation. So thank you very much. I'll be back in about 5-10 minutes with Mark Weber. But in the meantime, Shlomo, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Yeah, it has been a blast. Thank you very much. And I hope I can come back next year.
Excellent. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.